In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, does being overweight help you live longer? The dark side of fasting, the latest on caffeine and exercise performance, more Clubhouse Live Q&A, and much, much more.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
Jay, I'm feeling kind of guilty right now.
Ooh, this always begs the question as to why, so go for it.
I'm feeling kind of guilty because I did high-intensity exercise this morning. I did the
you bad boy,
good old-school, quick and dirty, Pavel Zatzaline-style Russian kettlebell workout where you do 10 intense kettlebell swings and then 10 push-ups, and I did 10 rounds of that with some nasal breathing on the Airdyne bicycle in between each. But, you know, the New York Times, hence my guiltiness, just released an article saying too much high intensity exercise may be bad for your health. And now a whole bunch of people have been asking me about that study and asking me if they should stop their high intensity exercise. And the subtitle of that article says that HIIT, you know, HIIT, high intensity interval training, may harm your mitochondria, the energy generators found in every cell of your body. And so, yeah. So that's the news on the streets. And I thought just because we have a lot of people who listen in, who are kind of into HIIT, we should probably address this issue.
It's worth discussing, man. I got sent this article by like three different people, and then I sent it over to you, and I was like, let me get Ben's take on this, because, you know, it was, you know, I'm sure we're going to get into it, but it was one of those things. I think that people, if they just see the initial title, they just, and that's what a bulk majority of people do. They read the title, they read one sentence in it, and they're like, okay, HIIT's out, not doing it anymore. But you still did it for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a few things to think about. They had 11 men and women. So this wasn't a massive study, and they were tracking things like their blood sugar level, their metabolic health. And what they did was 4 weeks of a pretty ambitious exercise program, meaning that during the first week they did a HIIT session that involved 4 minute long intervals, five times on a stationary bike with 3 minutes of rest in between those 4 minute long intervals. Okay. So we're talking about a duration of intensity that is well in excess of much of the gold standard research on HIIT, which is like 10 to 30 seconds in duration. Okay.
Right.
So these are 4 minute long efforts, five times through with 3 minutes of rest in between each. Now during week two, they added an extra session. And they added in more workouts, and then also 8 minute spurts of all out pedaling. So now they've doubled the exercise times. Now they're exercising for 8 minutes in addition to exercising for 4 minutes. And I'm not saying their total exercise duration was 8 minutes. I'm saying that was how long the intervals were that they were doing. And they continued this for 4 weeks with very little recovery, and you know, not any so-called periodization to give people a chance to kind of step back. But let's say that they had adequate recovery, and let's assume that these people were recovered. Either way, what they did was then they measured things like blood sugar stabilization. They measured things like the health of the mitochondria using muscle biopsies. And they were showing that the mitochondria were only producing about 60% as much energy as they had during previous weeks throughout the course of the study. And also they saw a high amount of glycemic variability, like a lot of seesawing spikes and dips during the day in terms of blood glucose. And so, here's what you need to understand in order to understand why what happened to the people who were in this study. When you're doing high intensity interval training, essentially you're breaking down ATP, okay? And you're breaking down ATP pretty rapidly. Now, ATP, when it's broken down, is converted into ADP and energy, or this phosphate molecule, right? You cleave one phosphate molecule off of adenosine triphosphate, And then what you're left with is adenosine diphosphate plus a phosphagenic energy molecule that can be burnt, you know. And, that's why when people take creatine, they say they have more energy. We talked about that in the last podcast episode. Mm-hmm. That was podcast. What was that? 425. So today's 426. So all the show notes are going to be at bengreenfieldfitness.com/426. That's why creatine phosphate can give you like some extra phosphagenic pools to use to replenish ATP more readily. But, you know, regardless of whether or not you have creatine on board, you know, the ATP, when you're doing high intensity exercise, gets broken down into ADP plus a phosphate molecule that gets burnt. And then you're left over, with AMP, adenosine monophosphate, and another phosphate molecule. Now, the thing is, there is evidence that once you completely exhaust the AMP stores, you can actually limit the mitochondrial response, potentially even decrease the ability of the mitochondria to produce energy. And that occurs in one of two scenarios: high intensity interval training duration that is too long, or inadequate recovery period of time in between the efforts. Arguably, you could also say that another thing that could cause that to happen would be just not having enough calories or enough ATP on board, meaning doing a bunch of HIIT in, say, like a fasted state. But ultimately, mm-hmm. the lion's share of the research on HIIT shows that once you exceed about 30 seconds, you're actually getting to that point where you're exhausting your AMP levels to the extent to where your AMP to ATP ratio is going up and up and up. And so what happens in that scenario is a whole bunch of lactic acid accumulation and a dip in the ability of the mitochondria to produce energy, the potential for overtraining, and a lot of the issues that have dictated, in my opinion, the smartest approach to high intensity interval training being very short efforts with long recovery periods. Okay. So that's why for me, like kettlebell swings, for me to do 10 kettlebell swings takes me about 10 to 15 seconds. And then I'm recovering, you know, for a good 60 seconds afterwards before I return back around to the next effort. Now I like to recover via like some nasal breathing on the bicycle, you know, bouncing around, you know, walking mm-hmm. around the backyard. But ultimately, this study was a very poorly conducted example of what high intensity interval training should look like. And furthermore, when we see a lot of the complaints out there about heart attacks, right? Heart attacks being associated with too much intense training. One of the reasons for that, and one of the reasons that some of the biggest damage from a heart attack comes after oxygen returns to the heart, is because the heart uses up all the phosphate. The mitochondria start producing free radicals. And essentially, when all the adenosine has been broken down, there's not enough what are called adenosine ribose frames, this protein framework, to accept the phosphate molecules. And then you start producing ammonia in the heart. And you create this acidic environment where the heart, which would normally ideally operate on ketones, is kind of forced into this like glycolytic state, very similar to what you'd see in, say, like a, you know, an out of control cellular clump that's developing cancer due to excess glycolysis. And so mm-hmm. you're doing damage to the heart, you're doing damage to the mitochondria, and the reason for that is efforts that are too long with inadequate recovery periods, sometimes in a state of a caloric deficit, such as fasted exercise. And so once you put all those variables together, all this study tells us is how you should be doing HIIT the right way and what the wrong way to do it would be. Does that make sense?
When I first read this article, I was kind of struck with something you and I had discussed. It was probably about a year or so ago when you first introduced me. It was an article that we posted. You first introduced me to the concept of high intensity repeat training or HIIT training, which is basically just exercising all out, like close to 100%, which is what HIIT should be or what HIIT should be, for about 10 seconds and then giving like a pretty gracious rest period. So for me, that's normally about 50 seconds. So like, let's say if I go high intensity, almost 100% for 10 seconds on my like concept rower, then for, you know, 50 seconds, I'm just going to do a light kind of easy breezy type row with nasal breathing exercises. And then after that, hit another 10 seconds as hard as I can. And then I'll generally do like anywhere from about 7 to 10 sets max. I mean, 10's really pushing it. And I've just found that, especially if I look at like data metrics, if I look at my Aura, if I look at my Whoop, if I do exercises like that, more hurt instead of hit, then I tend to have better biometric outcomes. I tend not to be overreaching or overtraining nearly as often. Whereas before, when I was doing hit, I was just kind of like muscling through it, like no pun intended. Like I was just saying, well, I don't care really what my biometrics say. Like this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I was overreaching. I was overtraining. I was getting hurt. And so for me, it's just been a much better option. And also too, from a psychological perspective, 10 seconds is a hell of a lot easier than thinking about, what'd you say, 8 minutes of high intensity? You can't go 8 minutes high intensity. Like maybe if you're doing like 60, 75%, but not 85 to 100%.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So I'll link to a great article that appeared on the Breaking Muscle website a couple of years ago on how to do what's this so-called HIIT, which is essentially what we've just described, HIIT, high intensity repeat training versus HIIT, high intensity interval training. And for most people, aside from the elite athlete who's trying to increase VO2 max, who's willing to put up with some of the potential damage that might occur to their heart or to their mitochondria or their overall metabolism from excess training, which is just kind of like a trade-off you make if you want to compete on the pointy edge of sports. I think HIIT is a far better way to train. Extremely short exercise session or interval training periods of 10 to 30 seconds in duration with very long recovery periods. 1 minute, like I explained I was doing this morning, is actually considered pretty dang short for a recovery period if you're truly going all out. Mm-hmm. And gold standard is closer to 3 to 4 minutes. So, right. Hopefully that's helpful for people who saw that study and were a little bit confused about whether or not they should be doing high intensity interval training. We actually kind of like jumped into the news flashes without actually introducing the news flashes. and when we do open it up for questions, just so all of you who are on Clubhouse know, for people who want to ask questions live, you can definitely ask questions about some of these things that we discuss in the news flashes, but we're not going to open up the floodgates for questions right now. So, there was one other thing I wanted to mention, then we'll move into the news flashes. I'm also super excited, Jay, because up on the Traeger grill on my patio right now, I've got a little kitchen experiment going on. I suppose
you had something going on last time with the whole wrapped meat thing, and now you got something new going.
Yeah, the Lomo El Trapo wrapped meat that turned out amazing. Go see my Instagram feed to take a look at that idea of wrapping a giant piece of tenderloin in a towel, soaking it in wine, adding a whole bunch of salt, and then tossing it on top of a giant fire. That worked really well. And I posted that to Instagram. It was a hit. Oh my gosh, it's so good. You cut it and it's like filet mignon tenderloins. But what I'm doing now, and by the way, shameless plug, my cookbook just went on pre-order at boundlesscookbook.com. If anybody wants to try out some of these crazy ass recipes I come up with, but here's my reasoning on this latest recipe I'm trying this morning. And this is super easy for any of you who want to try it, but I won't be able to tell you until tonight how it turned out. I'm taking my twin boys and my wife out to play tennis at about 6 p.m. Around 7, I'll come back and finish cooking this thing and let people know how it actually turned out. And I'll put it on Instagram. But Jay, have you ever been to a restaurant and had duck confit?
I have no clue what that is. I just know what the word duck is. And you said something that sounded French, maybe?
Okay. Confit, C-O-N-F-I-T. I'm going to educate you. That's the kind of like the ultra slow transformation of meat into just like rich, crispy skinned succulents. All it really means, if you see that on a menu, is they're taking the duck and cooking it in its own fat, or sometimes they'll use a different fat like lard or olive oil or something like that, but it's typically cooked, immersed, submerged in its own fat at a low temperature, not a frying temperature, but a very low temperature, 200 to 220 degrees or so for a good 6 to 8 hours. And when you do that and the meat is immersed in the fat, you get a tenderness on the level of like a deep fried Thanksgiving turkey without a lot of the oxidative byproducts that you're going to get from frying at a very high temperature. But then when you take that meat and you finish it by taking all that fat that it's been slow cooking in all day and give it a quick sear to get it crispy at the very end, you wind up with one of the most flavorful, wonderful, enjoyable pieces of, in most cases, poultry that you'll ever wrap your teeth around. And ooh, so duck confit is one of my favorite things to order at this local French restaurant named Florida Cells. that I go to. And so I was, these are the kind of things I think about while I'm laying in bed at night. I thought, well, why can't I take just, you know, any of these, you know, whole organic pastured chickens that I've got in my freezer, right? A lot easier to get my hands on than duck. And why couldn't I take that and basically cover it with a whole bunch of suet, which is like the fat that you'll typically find around the kidneys. I got a whole freezer full of suet from Belcampo. And so I just drenched the chicken in a mix of suet and coconut oil, because I almost didn't have enough suet to cover the chicken, in a Dutch oven pot, and then put it on the Traeger at 220 for about 8 hours, along with a host of different spices and herbs. In this case, I use like dill, salt, pepper, cayenne, paprika, rosemary, thyme, etc., with a little bit of bay leaf. And so it's about, I put it on at about 4:30 a.m. this morning because I've been getting up kind of early. So by about, by around noon or so, I'll check it. I'll pull it from the grill. I'll stick it in the fridge to sit in that fat for a while. Then tonight for dinner, I'll take it out and fry it up for the family. What do you think?
Huh. Man, it sounds really good. I love your adventurous spirit when it comes to cooking, because I would have not thought of that, because I mean, I didn't even know what the hell it was, but sounds amazing.
Yeah. So if any of you are listening and you got some extra coconut oil or any other form of fat or even like lard or whatever laying around and some chicken, try it. Dutch pot, cover it in fat, put it in the oven or the grill for about 8 hours, and that's it. And it's really kind of like a low maintenance recipe too, with whatever herbs you desire. So I'll put that one on Instagram later on. So that's at Instagram.com/BenGreenfieldFitness. The new cookbook is at boundlesscookbook.com. And I suppose we should jump into the news flashes.
Yeah, let's get going.
All right, so a few rapid fire news flashes before we jump into some discounts we want to give you guys, and then our live Q&A. A lot of people were pretty heartbroken when the news came out last year, or it may have been almost 2 years ago now, about our beloved Topo Chico water, which many, many people are huge fans of, especially if you live in Texas. Being shown to contain a variety of contaminants, including polyfluoroalkyl, which is abbreviated PFAS, which is a chemical substance that's linked to things like cancer and learning delays in children. And Topo Chico failed the test. They had extremely high amounts of PFASs. Yeah. So Topo Chico last month basically announced that it had upgraded its filtration system to ensure the continued safety and quality of Topo Chico into the future. And so those of you who decided to forego your Topo Chico habit based on that study that came out a couple of years ago, the good news that I have for you is Topo Chico is now once again thumbs up, low in PFAS. They've amped up their filtration capacity, and you can now drink Topo Chico again guilt-free. So yes. There you have it.
Yes. No, that's really, you don't know how depressed I was when that study came out and I had to put it away, because, you know, really, I had always drank Pellegrino and I really love Pellegrino, but there was something about Topo Chico that just had that like bite to it. It's got that like really crisp carbonation. I guess the mineral content just gives it a bit of a bite, and I missed it so much. And so when I saw this, when I was reviewing for today and I saw this article up, I was so excited and so happy. So I may head to Sprouts after our talk today, grab a 12 pack.
And of course, Pellegrino and Gerald Steiner are also up there. And one thing I should note for those of you who have seen me on the gram doing this, I take my Pellegrino now and I pour it through what's called like a water vortexer. It's this fancy copper water vortexer that basically, it structures the water. It causes the formation of these H3O2 molecules as it pours through this vortexing device. And so you essentially return it to a similar flavor and electrochemical potential as you would get if the water were straight from the spring. So you can take your carbonated bottled water and restructure it by pouring it through this device. Now I'll open my Pellegrino or my Topo Chico or my Gerald Steiner, pour it through this vortexer, and I'll link to that one in the show notes if you guys want to see what I'm using, this copper vortexer. And then, I pour it into a glass mason jar and then drink out of that. And the cool thing about this vortexer is I use it on wine. Like I drink the dry farm wines, amplifies the flavor of wine. You can use it for scotch, for whiskey, for vodka, any of your hard alcohols. You can use it for kombucha. It not only aerates whatever liquid that you use it with, but it also structures it. And so, I mean, playing around with liquids. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that InfoPathy device that I did a podcast on. You know, the one that'll impart frequencies into water. I had a dinner party at my house the other day, and I have a bunch of like local biohackers who I had over, and one guy he actually Matt Blackburn, shout out to my friend Matt Blackburn, who's got I think it's the MitoLife podcast. He said he was experimenting with the sildenafil frequency that thing has to basically impart the frequency of Viagra into the water that you're drinking. Yeah. So after that dinner party a few nights ago, I started doing in the afternoon sildenafil, and I am totally not kidding you. A near insti boner after I drank the water. And I don't know how much of that is placebo effect, right? Admittedly, you know, I should have done some type of double blinded trial where I had my kids do it and then they don't tell me which water it is and I drink that. But I have successfully repeated that experiment three times since. And every time I get swole.
Really?
Down under. Huh. So
have you used it before doing a workout?
Have I used it before workout? The sildenafil frequency?
As like a vasodilator for the workout. You know how bodybuilders will use sildenafil for workouts and get the crazy pump?
I've used it before a mattress workout, I can tell you that. Nice. But yeah, that actually sildenafil is banned by WADA for that reason, because it's such a potent nitric oxide precursor and performance enhancing aid. I haven't really experimented with it much pre-workout, but that's a good idea, especially if you're doing like any of these oxygen enhanced workouts, just because you get even more blood flow. So for any of you who are using like exercise with oxygen training, or even using hyperbaric oxygen chamber, anything you use prior to a session like that that will increase nitric oxide is actually going to improve the effects of that practice. And so yeah, this would be something to try for that as well. But isn't that cool that I can actually make my own drinkable water Viagra without actually going to any, say, like fringe international online websites to purchase off-label generic Viagra?
Right. It sounds crazy, and you are right. It could potentially be placebo, but who cares? It's working for you.
Yeah.
Just keep it up.
And for those of you who want to listen, that podcast that I did about that whole water device is at bengreenfieldfitness.com/infopathy, info, P-A-T, and it's not even that expensive. Infopathy. It's like $200.
Oh yeah, that's not bad at all.
Which, considering you've got access to thousands of chemicals and supplements and meds that you can infuse into your water, it's actually pretty cool. It almost feels like cheating, but
yeah, for sure. Does it reduce the amount of carbonation in your drink though? Because I feel like that would irritate me a little bit.
Like if you were to use Pellegrino, for example.
Yeah. Like when you put Pellegrino or Topo Chico through it, because I kind of like my bubbles.
Oh, no, we're talking about two different things. The water vortexing device is the first thing I was talking about. And then that InfoPathy water charger is a second thing. Hopefully that's not too. Okay. And I honestly use both. Like I pour it through the vortexer and then put it on the InfoPathy device. But neither seem to influence the carbonation that dramatically. And I'll link to all of these news flashes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/426. But there was also an interesting study, kind of similar to that HIIT study, a little bit of fear mongering almost, that came out that showed that belly fat becomes resistant to fasting, and that a new study showed that fasting essentially makes you fat. This also is one that I received a lot of emails and texts about, and so I thought I should clear up the air on this as well. This was a study that was published in the Cell Reports Journal. And what they found was that in fasted rodent models, there was a change in both forms of fat in their bodies, both the visceral fat, like the visceral belly fat, the fat tissue surrounding your organs, like your stomach, and then the subcutaneous fat, right, the fat that's just underneath your skin. And they found that in particular, the visceral fat, most significantly, actually became resistant to the release of fatty acids in these fasted rodent models, meaning that over time, as these rodents fasted, the visceral fat became less and less capable of releasing its own fatty acids to produce energy. And of course, this makes sense from an evolutionary or an ancestral standpoint, because when you are sending your body a signal that there are not enough calories to go around, so to speak, that triggers like a preservation signaling pathway in visceral fat and causes it long term to become resistant to releasing fatty acids, to breaking down fatty acids for energy, because it wants to store them. Right. And so they used a pretty cool, what's called proteomics form of measurement, where they measured more than 85 different proteins and enzymes located in fat deposits to show that there were cellular changes occurring that made the belly fat almost like resistant to fat loss. And so I went ahead and dug into this study a little bit more, because the news flashes didn't really tell the whole story. So first of all, what they did note across the board was an improvement in many actions that would be associated with improved metabolic health. Like they found a consistent increase in mitochondrial protein content and an increase in fatty acid synthesis pathways that were associated with decreased inflammation and improved insulin sensitivity. Which does make sense, because as these fat cells become more insulin sensitive, they're able to take up energy more quickly, sop up energy from the bloodstream and store it. And they also saw an improvement in mitochondrial and metabolic health, because the body became better equipped at being able to produce that ATP that we were talking about earlier. So it was good for the mitochondria. It was good for metabolic health. And despite that, they did note that the visceral fat was not able to break down quite as readily in these rodent models that were fasted. And so when I think about this, there's two things that you should understand. A, this was long-term fasting without refeeds, long-term calorie restriction in the absence of refeeds. Now, once you introduce refeeds into the equation, like let's say you do some form of calorie restriction for, let's say, 4 weeks in a row, but that calorie restriction is accompanied by like every Saturday or every Sunday, you're actually eating to slight caloric excess, or you're refilling your energy stores with a few meals that are actually giving you as much energy as you'd want. Like you're eating ad libitum, completely satisfying your appetite. That appears to stave off any issues with like thyroid downregulation, resistance to fat loss, etc. So there's a difference between long-term calorie restriction and long-term calorie restriction with refeeds. Okay, so I'm a bigger fan of including refeeds if you're trying to lose weight and you're using a diet approach to do so, you know, restricting calories to do so. So that's one thing. The other thing is that it appears that, and I'll get into this when it comes to aging momentarily and the anti-aging effects of fasting, but it appears that many of the benefits of fasting don't necessarily come from the caloric restriction, but from the so-called compressed feeding window, meaning it's not so much about restricting calories as it is about restricting the hours during the day in which you're consuming those calories, which is another feather in the cap for the intermittent fasting approach, where, you know, you might eat your normal, you know, for me, I typically eat 3,000 to 3,500 calories a day, but that's over the course of about 8 to 10 hours. And then I've got another anywhere from 10 to 16 hours during the day where I'm simply not eating. And so you'll get a lot of the benefits of fasting from that approach alone, and also be able to harness a lot of what they did show in this study, the improvements in mitochondrial efficiency, the improvements in the decreased inflammation in fat cells, the improvements in insulin sensitivity. So ultimately, the big takeaway from this study is don't get concerned that fasting is going to make you fat. Instead, just don't fast long term without including refeeds, and consider adopting more of an intermittent fasting approach than a strict caloric restriction approach. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes plenty of sense. Yeah, I think it's like you said, kind of similar to that article we talked about in HIT. you see the headlines here and you think, okay, therefore we need to throw away fasting because I'm just going to, you know, keep belly fat and it's going to just continue to grow and not go anywhere. It's not going to budge. No pun intended. I've done a lot of puns today. But you know, I think that it's true that like, it's not that fasting in and of itself is going to be detrimental. It's just how you fast, just like anything we do in life. So I think that those clarifications are extremely important.
Yep. Fully agreed. And then kind of related to this, a pretty good blogger in the anti-aging and longevity realm, a guy named Josh Mitteldorf, he writes some pretty compelling articles based on research in the field of aging. And he's written a series recently called Weight and Aging Paradox, two-part series. And it's very interesting because there is this kind of hypothesis going around, and it has been going around for several years, that to a certain extent, being overweight may have a metabolically protective effect, meaning slight amounts of cushion, so to speak, may actually lower your risk of mortality rather than as you expect, increasing your risk of mortality. And it sounds paradoxical, like you're saying, like being fat is going to help me mm-hmm. to live a longer time. But there was a study that came out of Ohio State University a couple of months ago. And it was based on the Framingham database, which has medical and demographic information, in this case, on about 5,000 people that they tracked over 74 years. And they found that the people who lived the longest were not only average weight when young, but they also gained weight, especially during their middle years. And the folks who were gaining weight as they aged actually showed a 40% the people who maintain what would be called a low to normal weight all through their lives, they had a 40% higher risk of death, higher all-cause mortality risk than those that actually gained slight amounts of weight as they aged. And so that seems a little bit paradoxical because we've always been told, as I alluded to a little while ago, that caloric restriction is associated with improved life expectancy in you know, largely mammalian models and also in yeast, fruit flies, et cetera. And you know, when you step back and look at things, though, this might suggest that calorie restriction doesn't necessarily extend human life capacity. Now, there's a few things to bear in mind here. A, when they're looking at the actual association between weight and longevity, they're looking at BMI. And BMI doesn't necessarily differentiate. Body mass index, that ratio between your height and your weight, doesn't necessarily account for muscle, meaning that maintaining or even increasing muscle as one ages maybe what's going on here, and it's not necessarily increasing weight, you know, ignorant or agnostic of what's going on in terms of whether that weight is fat weight versus muscle weight. But instead, it's this idea that maintaining muscle as you age could have a protective effect on mortality. And so that I think is something that isn't going to shock a lot of people. But and there still is good evidence for caloric restriction in humans. Like they found that food shortages during World War II in some European countries are associated with a pretty sharp decrease in coronary heart disease mortality, which then increased again after the war ended. They've shown that when folks lose weight, it seems to, based on methylation measurements, kind of turn back the aging clock a little bit. We find that when BMI increases, again, even though they're not differentiating between fat versus muscle, you seem to see an increase in C-reactive protein, a measurement of inflammation that might also be associated with an increase in aging or at least an increased risk of mortality. You know, we know that a loss in insulin sensitivity, which is sometimes associated with weight gain, may drive some different age-related diseases and that there's a strong correlation between BMI and obesity. But it still is interesting that in this Framingham study, weight gain didn't show up as a risk factor for faster aging. Now, in his comments on this, Josh had some interesting ideas as to why this might be the case. So, first of all, there is that part about higher BMI possibly indicating more muscle mass, not necessarily more fat mass. I think that definitely plays a factor. There's also the emotional hypothesis, and this is interesting, but when they look at profile of mood state scores and they look at so-called happiness factors, people who are slightly overweight tend to be a little bit happier, have higher levels of life satisfaction. So it's kind of interesting that by like enjoying food and not necessarily being like cold and libido-less your entire life, you may actually have a level of emotional enjoyment that might actually increase your lifespan a little bit. I'm not saying that by adopting an Epicurean philosophy of eating fried chicken in bed with lard dripping from your cheeks like Fat Bastard in the old Austin Powers movie is going to make you live longer, but you know, big glorious family dinners and celebrations and outings and going to some parties and, you know, having big meals like that may actually allow for a decreased rate of aging, even though you might have a little bit more, you know, cushion, so to speak, compared to people who are calorie restricting their entire lives or maintaining weight their entire lives. Another thing that may happen here is they're not differentiating that much between brown fat, right? Like metabolically active brown fat that you get from things like cold thermogenesis and cold training, for example, as playing a factor here, right? So part of it might be, well, you don't necessarily have more fat overall, but you have more brown fat. And I think a lot of these like polar bear swimmers in the Bay Area have shown that you can live longer and be fat if that fat is really good metabolically active brown fat because you have a robust cold thermogenesis practice. So that might be part of it as well. Then there's also this idea that I alluded to earlier, that calorie restriction and being lean is not necessarily what would cause you to age more slowly or increase lifespan, but rather it's simply time-restricted eating. And so you could, for example, be normal weight or slightly higher than average weight or higher than average BMI. But if you're still intermittent fasting and having these compressed feeding windows, you're basically reducing your risk of that slightly higher weight being problematic or the slightly higher calorie intake being problematic. And so there's a variety of factors to think about here. But ultimately, the big takeaway is that if you are constantly calorie restricting, maintaining very low body fat percentage, you know, exercising intensively, and as we've already established, doing like too much, say, high intensity exercise in a calorically deprived state, etc., don't fool yourself into thinking that that is actually going to help you live longer. It may actually decrease lifespan versus a strategy of intermittent fasting, eating really good nutrient dense and even sometimes calorie dense amounts of food, exercising in a way that doesn't totally deplete you every time that you exercise. That appears to, based on some of the data that we're seeing, be a better strategy for longevity versus just strict calorie restriction and excessive exercise. So I don't know if that's going to be a huge newsflash for folks. I think that that's kind of intuitive for a lot of people. But, you know, especially in the fitness world, I think we still have this approach of beating ourselves up, calorie restricting, excessively exercising, having very long training sessions in terms of the time of the intervals that we're doing high intensity interval training. And I don't think any of that is actually doing a good job helping us to live longer versus maintaining just a little bit of extra weight.
Yeah, you know, when you first started talking about this study, my first thing, especially when you mentioned BMI, was my mind immediately ran to the whole, you know, subject of muscle mass and kind of how that factors into BMI. And I thought about myself. I mean, I'm actually considered overweight. However, right now my body fat percentage is around 11 to 12%. I'm just really tall, I'm broad, I'm muscular, and so those things make me in a higher BMI category. But I would believe that the things that I'm doing, especially from a fitness exercise regimen, are kind of adding to my overall sense of wellness, but also to longevity. So yeah, I think that that's a huge variable in here. And then another thing you said, Ben, that was really interesting was the emotional component. I think a lot of times people think that when you become depressed or anxious, but especially depressed, that people tend to just kind of gorge themselves with food. And that's actually quite the opposite. That's a bit more of kind of the other extreme. That doesn't happen nearly as frequently as as people who lose their appetite and don't eat nearly as much, and they lose a ton of weight. And so we have to remember there's so many variables in here. And so I don't think the study is just saying like, hey, the fatter you are, the happier you are. You have to kind of look at the asterisk beside that and see that there are different things that you have to parse
right.
out for sure.
You can be depressed emotionally eating fat, and you can be, I am loving life and having amazing dinners with my family, normal to slightly high weight. And then the other thing to bear in mind here is that the way that BMI is calculated dictates that people who are shorter are always going to, based on that calculation, have a higher BMI. And yeah. Short people tend to live significantly longer than tall people. Even know about Loron dwarfism, where they've shown that these dwarfs have very low levels of insulin-like growth factor 1. And Dr. Rhonda Patrick, I believe, is probably the person who's talked about this the most. And there's this idea that slightly lower levels of growth hormone, slightly lower levels of IGF-1 may allow for longer life. And so short people would technically tend to live slightly longer anyways, and that might kind of skew this as well. So ultimately, though, I think it's interesting to think about, and I just want to put a warning out there to people who are just like, living this extremely stoic lifestyle. You might be missing out on quite a bit of enjoyment and not even inducing the longevity benefits that you think you might be inducing, versus sane amounts of caloric restriction or intermittent fasting, combined with things like cold exposure, high intensity repeat training, and some of those things that we do know could extend lifespan without excessively beating up the body. So,
right. Indeed.
Now there's one other thing that I wanted to mention that I think was super duper interesting. And that was the latest research that came out on coffee. And this was, not coffee, really. It was caffeine. The yeah. International Society of Sports Nutrition position stand on caffeine and exercise performance recently came out, and some of the takeaways from that, if I could go through some of the bullet points kind of rapid fire with you, I think were super duper interesting, especially mm-hmm. for people who like to have their coffee. So a few of the things in this study, which was titled The International Society of Sports Nutrition Position Stand on Caffeine and Exercise Performance. First of all, they did, of course, no surprises here, found that caffeine improves physical performance dramatically in both trained and untrained individuals, and that if you abstain from caffeine for a certain period of time, such as 10 to 14 days prior to an exercise session, then consume caffeine, that the magnitude of those effects is pretty significantly increased, particularly for aerobic exercise and aerobic endurance. And so the other thing, though, that they found that was interesting was that some of the things that seem to be better in terms of a delivery mechanism for caffeine, specifically if you're consuming caffeine to enhance your workout or to enhance sports performance, is anything where the caffeine stays in your mouth. Okay, so caffeinated chewing gum. Mouth rinses, meaning literally just like taking one of those caffeinated gels and swishing it around in your mouth, then spitting it out, or some type of caffeinated mint or gum or any caffeinated substance, or even like a no-dose tablet or whatever, and just like keeping that in the mouth, energy gels, energy chews, those type of things specifically, or more significantly for aerobic exercise, have a really dramatic effect versus just like chewing and swallowing or having a cup of coffee prior to your workout. So actually having it in your mouth seems to help out quite a bit. So those were a couple of things, but then there were a few other interesting takeaways as well from this caffeine exercise performance paper. There's a big individual response. If you are a fast caffeine metabolizer, with something as simple as your 23andMe results would show, significant improvements in exercise performance via the use of caffeine. If you're a slow metabolizer, sometimes not only less performance improvements, but worsened performance in response to caffeine. So if you take your genetic results and it shows that based on your CYP genes, you're a slow caffeine metabolizer, you may actually want to avoid caffeine prior to exercise. So that's something to think about. Another one is that If you are not going to chew or like suck on like a caffeinated like mint or piece of gum during exercise, which appears to be the best way to take in caffeine during exercise, the best timing strategy appears to be 60 minutes prior to exercise. So if you are going to have that cup of coffee or pre-workout drink that has caffeine in it, some people suck that down and then go work out, but it appears an hour before is when the best effects will kick in. And so, you know, if you're getting ready to work out and you're thinking about your pre-workout, you may actually want to time your pre-workout, if it's a caffeinated pre-workout, up to an hour prior to your exercise session rather than right before your exercise session. And so that's another interesting takeaway. Caffeine did not seem to affect hydration status, exacerbate dehydration, or alter thermoregulation, even in high heat exercise environments. So you don't have to worry about using caffeine during exercise, even exercise in the heat. Furthermore, caffeine also seemed to benefit athletes who are performing at altitude. It offset the negative effects of hypoxia. And so if you're competing at altitude, it turns out that caffeine may actually be pretty helpful for that as well. I'm trying to think if there were any other big takeaways. I guess the last thing to consider is that if you consume caffeine post-workout with your post-workout meal, if you're one of those people who wants to consume a post-workout meal, which as I've talked about in previous podcasts, is something that's really only that necessary if you're going to be exercising again within the next 8 hours, like if you're a two-a-day type of person. If you have your post-workout meal with some caffeine, you replenish your glycogen much more quickly. And so you can actually, you know, if you're not going to take a nap or something like that, you can actually take caffeine with a post-workout meal, especially if you're an athlete. Again, that would be, you know, the person who's maybe in a tournament or a competition where they got to compete again and they're refueling right after they've competed once, or you're somebody who likes to work out in the morning and then again in the evening. Having coffee or caffeine post-workout along with your post-workout meal, if that post-workout meal has carbs in it, will help you to assimilate those carbs more quickly. And you'll replenish your muscle glycogen more quickly if you include caffeine with your post-workout meal. So, I really appreciated the ISSN digging in. This is in the Journal of the International Society of Sports Nutrition, just laying everything out. Really nice bullet point format on all the different ways to use caffeine during exercise. And I'll link to the full paper in the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/426. And I do realize We're getting a little bit long in the tooth with our intro, and I do want to allow time for some Clubhouse Q&As. Here we go.
Hey, Ben, how you doing? Thanks for Sophia calling me up. I love listening to the podcast. I mean, Mike, I know you were talking about maximizing your workout. I know you mentioned that you don't use like Tadalafil or any of those type of. Do you use, first of all, I got a big question is, A, what do you do in terms of boosting? What is your go-to for boosting nitric oxide? If you're doing some type of like KAATSU or some type of blood flow restriction, does that change what you're doing to increase blood flow? Are you using any type of like a BPC 157 with your workout? What is your best pre-workout regimen that you use with your clients? I know my patients are very aggressive in what they want to use in terms of their pre-workout. I know you are as well, so I'm really curious to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, you know, this kind of popped up a little bit during the last podcast 425, this idea about ways that you could increase nitric oxide naturally without the use of things like, say, you know, Viagra, or even arguably supplements like, you know, arginine or citrulline, et cetera. And so we had a big podcast where we talked about all these different ways that one could increase nitric oxide naturally. Obviously, there are some of these foods that work really well, like beets or, you know, arugula, or any of these nitrate rich foods. But the interesting thing is that, and I think I'm trying to remember which podcast this was. I think it was podcast. Do you remember, Jay, the one where we did the big nitric oxide show?
I remember doing it. I want to say it was probably about 5 or 6 podcasts ago. So maybe around like the 418, 419 area.
Okay. All right. Gotcha. So one thing that we brought up during that show was, it's really interesting. If you have a good oral microbiome, you actually convert the nitrates from those food sources into nitric oxide more readily. And so what that means is, if you are using mouthwash frequently, or using any fluoridated mouth product more frequently, like fluoridated toothpaste, for example, or drinking high amounts of fluoridated water from your municipal water supply, you actually decrease that conversion. So maintaining a really good oral microbiome is one thing that's important for naturally increasing your nitric oxide levels. In addition to that, photonic light, specifically from the red light spectrum, infrared, and even to a lesser extent, recent research has showed that even UVA and UVB can introduce this effect as well, can increase nitric oxide, which is why I think they've come out with several studies now showing that infrared sauna can decrease cardiovascular mortality risk. And probably a big part of that is due to the management of blood pressure and other cardiovascular parameters via the increase in nitric oxide. Furthermore, they've shown that even if vitamin D levels do not increase appreciably, you actually see a lot of these cardiovascular benefits in response to UVA and UVB radiation. And the hypothesis from that is that UVA and UVB radiation from the sunlight may also do a good job increasing nitric oxide. So sunlight / infrared saunas, in addition to a good oral microbiome combined with nitrate-rich fruits or vegetables like beet or arugula, that's also a really good strategy. There is one product, and I guess this would count as a supplement, but it's probably the most impressive one that's not Viagra that exists out there. It's made by my friend Dr. Nathan Bryan, who's probably one of the better nitric oxide researchers out there, and that's called Neo40. Neo40, and you can actually get these mouth test strips to test nitric oxide in your mouth. And kind of the more red they turn when you put them in your mouth, the higher the levels of your nitric oxide are. And it turns out that for me, when I tested my nitric oxide levels using these strips and combined it with Neo40, like they would get bright red using this Neo40. And so a lot of people swear by that stuff. So that's another really, really good way to do it. What else? Jay, you got anything on your end for ways that you could naturally increase nitric oxide?
I think you hit on the ones that I would mention. I know he was, I don't know if the question was fully natural because he was asking about things like, peptides and whatnot. And so I can discuss kind of my utilization of different supplements. I put that in air quotes, which nobody can see me in. But that is actually something I was referring to earlier and I wasn't supposed to be referring to it, which was nicotine. I think you hit on all the natural ones, but for me, a big one is just like a piece of loosey gum before I work out. That's been probably the most.
Yeah, but nicotine, you should know that's a vasoconstrictive. A lot of people even develop erectile dysfunction with long-term use of nicotine. So, theoretically, nicotine would actually act to counteract what you'd be looking for when it comes to nitric oxide, dictating that if you were using nitric oxide or if you're using nicotine for its exercise performance benefits, which it does have, you would actually want to be even more adamant about finding ways to increase your nitric oxide or taking some kind of blood flow precursor prior to workout, because nicotine may actually shut down some of that effect. So,
yeah, I was actually thinking, well, I guess I know in as far as like dilating cerebral arteries, I know that it was effective, but I guess I didn't realize like from a muscular tissue perspective, it was the opposite.
Yeah. And especially for something like, for something like erectile dysfunction, it's also something that can exacerbate that nicotine use. So you do need to be careful to really pay attention to nitric oxide levels if that's the case. But for me, I like to think that I'm getting a huge nitric oxide boost every single morning because I get up, I do breath work, including nasal breathing, which is a really good way to increase nitric oxide and something that I do during exercise. But then every morning while I'm drinking my coffee or my cacao or whatever I happen to be drinking in the morning and kind of working on emails and articles, et cetera, I do 20 minutes of these Juve red lights, like the red light therapy. So every morning I'm getting this big boost of nitric oxide. And, admittedly, now that I'm drinking magical sildenafil water again in the afternoon, there's another boost right there. And so, that combined with we always have like roasted beets and arugula and stuff like that in the refrigerator. We eat a lot of those. I don't use a lot of mouthwash or anything else that keeps my mouth super duper clean. I don't have halitosis, don't worry, but I'm pretty careful to not like nuke all the bacteria in my mouth. Those are a few of kind of the low hanging fruits when it comes to nitric oxide, but I'd say, sunlight, nasal breathing, exercise, and nitrate-rich vegetables, along with a good oral biome, is the best way to just naturally keep your nitric oxide levels elevated. And then finally, as far as pre-workout stacks, go listen to my podcast with Milo Sarkev, the bodybuilder, because we get into some pretty potent pre-workout stacks. Probably, just to tell you exactly what I, and this is going to get kind of weird for you guys, but I'll tell you exactly what I do pre-workout these days. Whether it's, you know, if I'm doing my hard workout in the morning, which I'll do on a day where I just know, like this afternoon, we have family tennis. I'm not going to do my afternoon workout because I'll be out playing tennis with the kids. So I did that kettlebell workout this morning instead. But what I do these days is, like Jay, pre-workout, I often will pop a little nicotine lozenge or a piece of nicotine gum. And then, as I have reported in the past, I get this Zen spray, which is like an oxytocin, peppermint, rosemary, Amazonian herb hape nasal spray from my friend Dr. John Lawrence. I do about 3 huffs of that per nostril. So it feels for a moment like someone's punched me in the back of the skull, and it just amps up my sympathetic nervous system, my body temperature, everything. And I also do about 3 drops of the Sananga eye drops that we talked about in the last podcast, which make me go blind for about 2 minutes. So this sounds like a pretty painful way to go into a workout. But by the time I start the workout, I've got that nasal spray, the nicotine, the Sananga eye drops, and I just crush it for like a half hour. And what I also like about that is because I often do my hard workouts like later afternoon to early evening, I'm not putting anything into my system, such as caffeine, that's going to interfere with my sleep later on because of the relatively short half-life of nicotine and the fact that even like that hape and those eye drops don't interfere with sleep patterns. And if anything, I found the eye drops actually give you really cool lucid dreams or more intense, vivid dreams. So that's kind of my pre-workout right now. So great question. Let's take another one.
Hey, Ben. It's me, Joey. I wanted to know, as far as like the leg workouts, you know, because I'm trying to stay pretty thin and try to stay lean. And, you know, I really listen to your podcast. I get so much from what you offer the community. But like, as far as like building muscle mass in my legs, can you do that every day? Is that something, you know, like I know the abs you can work out every day. Is like, you know, building muscle mass in your legs, is that something you would suggest to do on a daily basis?
There are some exercise protocols out there that anecdotally, not a lot of human clinical research, but anecdotally show that strategies such as like a daily barbell squat workout or daily stimulus of the leg muscle fibers, even on a daily basis without that 48 to 72 hours of recovery that you would expect to be recommended for idealizing hypertrophy, can actually allow for appreciable gains in muscle mass tissue in the legs. And so, you know, doing a leg workout every day, if it were a formal leg workout, meaning, you know, you got whatever, squats, lunges, leg extensions, reverse hypers, glute ham raises, you know, whatever the case may be, that's probably a significant enough workout to where you're not going to get adequate recovery if you're doing that every day. And you should have a good 48 to 72 hours of recovery between those workouts. But if you're doing more of what would be called like a stim workout, where you're just stimulating those muscle fibers for a brief period of time and not causing an amount of calcium influx, inflammation, muscle fiber tearing, eccentric muscle tissue damage, et cetera, that would occur with a longer, more appreciable workout, you could theoretically hit it every day. And what I mean by that is, for example, one single squat set to failure per day, or, you know, or having, you know, like a set course of like, you know, walking loaded lunges or farmer's walks that you're doing on a daily basis. I mean, there's a reason that Tour de France cyclists have thunder thighs, and they're definitely not doing a cycling workout and then taking 3 days off, then doing another one. They're literally hitting their legs every day. And I understand that that's non-weight bearing. It's less eccentric. It's more of almost like an endurance-based form of exercise with a significant amount of fast switch muscle fiber activation because of the level of power those people are putting out during the those interval training workouts. But I would say it kind of depends. If you're talking about leg workouts, like cycling, running, rucking, hiking, et cetera, you could actually do something like that every day. And provided you have ample calories on board and you're not catabolizing muscle, especially ample protein on board, you could see some leg growth. And then the other strategy would be shorter, kind of like triggering or stimulus workouts for the legs, like a single squat set to failure on a daily basis that you might throw down before dinner, for example, to also upregulate glucose transporters and allow you to be more metabolically sensitive to dinner. Like, you could do things like that. I wouldn't do a formal hefty leg training workout every day, though. You're just not going to see enough recovery for growth in a scenario like that. So, you know, that's kind of the skinny on the leg piece. And by the way, the guy who asked that question, that was Joey from a shout out to Joey's Hot Sauces. That's the only hot sauce I use now. Joey introduced me to it a few nice. Months ago. It's like all these organic red peppers and habaneros. And, I've got like 12 bottles of Joey's hot sauce in my pantry. I'll like give it out to people when we have dinner parties. And like, I sell everybody that has Joey's hot sauce, 'cause it's amazing. And you know, you don't get all the toxic ingredients you do in a lot of these condiments. It's kind of like, Primal Kitchen has their mayos and their ketchups and their mustards. I've got a whole pantry full of that. And then I have a whole pantry full of Joey's hot sauces. And I think Joey gave us a discount link somewhere. So I'll hunt that down and put it in the show notes for you guys who want to try Joey's hot sauce blend. I guess that's a benefit of these clubhouses, is kind of like that dude got on last week and was pimping his mattress company. When right. people get on and ask questions, it's a little back end way to highlight their business as well.
I was just gonna say, I had one thing to say about that too, because Joey made a comment, that I'd just like to address. Because I think you're right. Like, if you're kind of doing an all out full formal leg workout, like, you're just going to end up overtraining. You're not going to give adequate time for recovery. And Joey had mentioned something like you can work out abs every day. And this is actually kind of and I'm not calling maybe what Joey is saying necessarily a fallacy, but what I will say is that there are some individuals who they do believe that they can go in the gym, you know, hit a hard workout on whatever they're doing, and then kind of finish off with abs, and then just every day just pound abs, and they end up locking up their stomach. They don't see any gains. They're just kind of always sore. And so I think it's one of those things that you listen to your body and don't overtrain these things, because that is going to just lead to a detriment in your progress. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that. Like you said, you can do workouts on certain muscle groups each day, but I wouldn't make them formal all out just like to exhaustion with repeated sets. I think that kind of that single set to failure is probably a little bit, you know, better suited for people.
Yep. Noted. Good question. All right, let's take another one.
So this is Arjan from Amsterdam. Thanks, Ben, for sharing all your knowledge. Really appreciate it. So my question is, I'm kind of a fasting enthusiast, and I've done quite some fasts for over 72 hours. But are there any benefits for fasting over 72 hours? And is there a maximum until it's still healthy?
Oh, well, there's absolutely data that shows that once you exceed the 16-hour mark of fasting, you see a marked improvement in autophagy. And then in terms of like mucosal cell turnover in the gut, healing of the gut lining, et cetera, these longer fasts, you know, even in excess of 24 hours, and, you know, these 3 to 5 day water fasts for people who do have appreciable amounts of gut inflammation, SIBO, et cetera, that sometimes if they can get past the discomfort of that extended caloric restriction, it can produce profound improvements, sometimes a complete reversal of a lot of gut issues. You also see improvements in insulin sensitivity. You see increased cellular autophagy. You can see, especially when combined with things like sauna, or the use of binders like charcoal, a decrease in metal accumulation and a release of toxins from the body. I mean, there's a lot that happens once you exceed the kind of the classic intermittent fasting type of window of 12 to 16 hours. But of course, there are all of the potential metabolic downsides of doing that frequently that we've already highlighted earlier in this show on, you know, the kind of the paradoxical relationship between caloric restriction and aging. So based on that, you know, my general recommendations to folks from a fasting standpoint is as follows. For premenopausal women, fasts of longer than 12 hours done frequently appear to be not so good from an endocrine function standpoint. hormones, fertility, etc. So most women, I recommend a 10 to 12 hour intermittent fast on as many days of the year as possible without exceeding that 12 hour mark very often, if at all. For men, it appears to be closer to 12 to 16 hours to harness a lot of, say, like the longevity or the metabolic benefits of intermittent fasting or restricted feeding window. So premenopausal women, 10 to 12 hours, men, and postmenopausal women, 12 to 16 hours, you know, 365 days a year if you want to. And then to tap into some of these benefits of longer fasting periods, a couple of things. I like to encourage people, one, up to four times a month to do a 24-hour fast, such as dinner time to dinner time. Saturday dinner, put down your fork, don't eat again until Sunday at dinner, or, you know, Friday dinner to Saturday dinner fast. And that just seems to be something a lot of people can kind of wrap their heads around and do one to four times a month, such as just identify one day of the week where you're going to do a 24-hour dinner to dinner fast, a so-called OMAD approach, one meal a day. And then finally, some type of a quarterly cleanup where you're engaging in more significant levels of autophagy, once in the spring, once in the summer, once in the winter, and once in the fall. You do something like a juice fast, like the one I recently wrote about, or a Khichdi cleanse, or, you know, or an Ayurvedic cleanse, a so-called Panchakarma type of cleanse, or a Valter Longo fasting mimicking diet approach where you're eating 30 to 40% of the number of calories that you would normally consume over a 4 to 5 day span, or for those of you masochists out there, even something as significant as a water fast for 3 to 5 days. And I personally, because I'm just supremely curious and like to immerse myself in all different forms of fasting, you know, I'll just kind of pick and choose when my quarterly cleanup rolls around what I want to do. You know, if there's some new fasting protocol out there, sometimes I'll experiment with it. But every quarter, I try to do something that's a little bit more intensive when it comes to cellular autophagy. And so I've got the daily intermittent fast, the weekly up to one time a month, 24-hour dinner to dinner fast, and then the quarterly, you know, so-called cleanup fast. And that's what I do for myself. That's what I encourage for a lot of the clients who I'm working with. And it just works. It seems to be something people can wrap their heads around, and it works. And so, yeah, you get benefits once you exceed 16 hours, and the benefits from an autophagy standpoint seem to improve and increase, you know, the longer that you go. But again, you just have to understand that there are some metabolic trade-offs when it comes to thyroid downregulation, endocrine downregulation, energy levels, you know, enough glycoprotein to go around for healthy joints, etc. So you just wouldn't want to overdo that level of fasting. And of course, this is also dependent on things like body type, how much storage fat you have available, your metabolic efficiency, and how long you might have been experimenting with things like low carb or keto or caloric restriction or fasting, dictating your ability to be able to mentally or physically be able to handle longer fasts. But ultimately, yeah, there's benefits to longer fasts, but that doesn't mean you do it all the time, in the same way that there's benefits to like hard and heavy weight training workouts or sauna sessions or cold sessions, but you wouldn't want to exceed them. Just like anything, you know, fasting should be treated as a hormetic stressor, and especially for the longer, bigger hormetic stressors. If you're doing those, you do them more infrequently and typically follow them up with a pretty significant form of self-care. What I mean by that is, you know, if you've done a 5 day fast, you want to spend like, you know, the next week or so eating some pretty nutritionally dense, even arguably calorie dense foods, so that you're kind of reigniting the body's metabolism and endocrine status, so to speak. So it's kind of like that feast, fast type of approach cycled throughout the year. Great question. Let's take one more question.
Hi, I'm Anna Bacchino, and nice to talk to you, Ben, and Sophia, and Jay, and thank you for having me. And Ben, you've been in my garage when Vinny Tortorich and I were recording, and we filmed a video with your shirt off. I think he was painting something on your shirt. I can't remember, but I'm going to have Vinny find that video from one back in the vault. It was I don't know why he never put it up, but I didn't come up here to say that. I just wanted to say hi. I wanted to know, because you were talking about fasting, so perimenopausal women, of which I am a member of this group, I did a 28-day carnivore challenge. And because of my celiac, I don't eat eggs or dairy, so I can't tolerate them. So it was very much a strict muscle meat and the occasional organ meat challenge. And I really, really struggled with it. In fact, I dropped about 17 pounds, and I wondered if it was mostly because I was fasting, because I just I couldn't choke it down, to use a less graphic phrase. I can't think of one. And then re-adding back in, so kind of getting to almost like a keto, I guess what they would call keto carnivore, adding back in vegetables and a few nuts, not too many. I don't want to tempt fate. I immediately gained back 12 of the 17 pounds. Not immediately, like it took about 4 or 5 weeks. But I was wondering if that's, is that normal? Am I doing the wrong thing? I didn't enjoy the carnivore. I don't see that that's something, place that I would go for the long term. But is it something that you would recommend, like maybe for 2 weeks instead of 28 days? Or am I doing something wrong? What can I do better? Thank you.
Hey, Anna, great question. Yeah, I remember doing that podcast in the garage with Vinny. That was fun. I was down in L.A., the Vinny Tortorich Show. And I think you guys, and then I'll answer your question. Didn't Vinny just come out with some kind of like fat documentary, like eating fat documentary?
Yeah, he has two documentaries out now. Since we've seen each other, he has two documentaries demystifying fat and fat too. I have two low-carb/keto cookbooks, Eat Happy and Eat Happy Too. We're not very creative with our naming, our nomenclature, but we'll get there. But hi, nice to see you.
Nice. Okay, cool. We'll link to those documentaries in the show notes. I actually haven't seen them yet, but somebody was telling me about them the other day, so I still have to check them out. I tend to convert documentaries to audio and listen to them while I'm doing things like hiking or riding my bike, so I miss out on probably like half of the cinematic imagery in a documentary, but I just don't spend a lot of time sitting in front of a TV. However, I will either watch it and or listen to it. To get to your question, yes, that's quite common to see some gastric distress, some blah feeling, et cetera, if you are shifting into, let's say, like a carnivore diet type of protocol. There's a few reasons that can happen. One is that there's a pretty significant change in the gut biome when you dramatically change your diet from like high carb to low carb, from high fiber to low fiber, from vegetables to meat. The makeup of your bacteria shifts dramatically. And for example, as you cut out carbohydrates, which is quite common on a carnivore type of diet, the carbohydrate-loving bacteria tend to fight back. In many cases, you will get diarrhea as your biome shifts in a very similar manner as you might get diarrhea or some kind of Herxheimer reaction when you adopt a new probiotic or quit a certain probiotic. And so there are some microbiome shifts that are pretty dramatic that seem to, in most people, diminish after about 2 weeks on something like a carnivore diet. But that kind of like liquid poo, paint the back of the toilet seat type of phenomenon is not uncommon in people who adopt a carnivore diet. And a big reason for that is the shift in the microbiome. And I'm unaware of any like special magical probiotic that you could take to reduce that effect. The only thing that I've found amongst people to kind of adjust it would be to start into a carnivore diet, but include things that help to bulk up the stool, such as like a chia seed slurry or like a sea moss gel. Of course, that would be considered cheating on a carnivore diet, but at least kind of staves off some of the diarrhea issues. Yeah, go ahead.
I did take HCL betaine. I anticipated this because when I asked around everybody who was doing carnivore, what's your biggest advice? And the biggest advice was don't trust a fart. And so I was like, oh, well, that's very telling. And so I did take HCL betaine stomach enzymes every time I ate. And I think that helped because I managed to avoid what you're talking about. But yes, I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, HCL will help. However, in most people, what helps even more is bile, such as ox bile extract. Because when you consume fats, your gut releases this hormone called CCK, which is cholecystokinin. That makes your gallbladder contract and release bile that's stored there. Then that emulsifies the fat and allows for the fat to be absorbed from other enzymes. And the gallbladder is kind of like a muscle. Like if you're all of a sudden asking it to produce more bile, it takes some time for it to do that. And so some people will supplement with any digestive enzyme that not only includes HCL, but also some type of like an ox bile extract, for example. Believe it or not, liver supplement or liver intake or organ meat intake seems to help out with the bile production as well. And so, the one I like for this is Thorne's Biogest. That's a pretty good digestive enzyme supplement that helps with bile acid production and also includes ox bile extract in it. So bile is another one that can be very helpful, and that's one that you may want to consider in addition to HCL. So Another thing that can cause kind of a blah feeling on something like a carnivore approach would be too much protein relative to fat. That's a very common cause of diarrhea, is switching to a carnivore diet, but doing kind of like more of the, you know, the Costco ribeye steak for breakfast, lunch, and dinner type of approach versus the kind of like the classic nose to tail approach that Dr. Paul Saladino is championing, which would be, you know, a lot more of like the suet, the bone marrow, the bone broth, the organ meats, the fattier cuts of meat, and taking in more of the fat and then including bile and even HCL to a certain extent, and avoiding just the lean proteins is another thing that seems to help out quite a bit when it comes to being able to digest better a carnivore-based diet, and also avoid some of the hyperammonia that might be associated, or the hyperamino acidemia that might be associated with excess protein intake in the absence of natural amounts of fat. You know, that's why nearly everybody, you know, even way back to the Arctic explorers, like, you know, what's his name, Vilhelmur Stefansson, you know, he was an early champion of the carnivore diet, and he really suggested adding in additional fat based on this concept of what would be called rabbit starvation, or too much protein in the absence of enough fat. And then the last thing is, some people don't respond well to a carnivore diet if it is associated with a high amount of potentially inflammatory products, like processed fat products, like processed tallow. For some people who are including dairy, high amounts of dairy, which inflames many people, egg whites versus whole eggs, non-ruminant foods, and especially non-ruminant foods that have been fed grains, you know, like chicken and pork, higher in omega-6 fatty acids. Those would be two such examples, especially, you know, pork that isn't pastured pork, or pork that's been bred to be the other white meat, lower in fat. And so paying attention to the actual sources and eliminating any potentially inflammatory sources of meat on a carnivore diet is also something that seems to help out quite a bit. But, you know, in a nutshell, if you're experiencing gastric distress, switching to a carnivore diet, understand some of that's normal due to the shifts in your microbiome. Understand that a lot of it can be mitigated by including a good digestive enzyme with something like bile. Understand that a lot of it can be mitigated by eating more of a nose-to-tail, higher-fat approach. And then understand that a lot of it can be mitigated by decreasing any of the potentially inflammatory foods that might be associated with, like, dirty carnivore, right? Like dairy and processed fats and egg whites, or, you know, or non-natural chicken and pork, etc. So those are a few of my tips, and I hope that's helpful. And I'm kind of to the point now on this podcast, by the way, where because I have another important phone call coming up in about 10 minutes that I have to be on, we will need to start to wrap things up. But before we wrap things up, first of all, I hope you guys are enjoying it when we do these live on Clubhouse. We'll continue to try to hurdle some of the technical issues that we run into. But if you guys really enjoy these Clubhouses, we will definitely keep doing them, because it seems like we've got a decent number of people in the room, and people are listening and asking questions. So I'm totally game to keep doing this. I think it's fun. What do you think, Jay?
Oh man, I love it. Yeah, it's really fun just to be able to interact. I mean, it's not that I don't enjoy the one-on-one calls that we have been, but having other people in the room to listen to us,
yeah,
it's fun.
Yeah, a few hundred flies on the wall. They can hear all of our embarrassing live editing mistakes. And And then also, I'll put all the show notes over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/426. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/426. If you like what we're doing, honestly, you guys, those of you live, those of you listening to the recording after it comes out, one of the best things you can do to support this show is not only to visit the show notes and check out all the goodies that we have over there, support our sponsors, et cetera, but leave this show a rating, whether it's Spotify or whether it's like Samsung or Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen in. I realize it's a pain in the ass and an extra step, but if you go and just like write one sentence and leave a review, based on all these podcast algorithms, it's one of the best things you can do to support this show and to support our labor of love, so to speak. And so if you're able to drop in, leave a review, it's tremendously helpful. Sometimes, even though it seems this is occurring with increasing rapidity and frequency, we don't have time to do special giveaways and goodies for people who leave reviews. We do occasionally. We do occasionally do some cool giveaways to the reviews that we read on the show. So we'll get back to doing that pretty soon. And then grab my new cookbook. Grab my new cookbook. I'll let you know on Instagram at instagram.com/BenGreenfieldFitness how that chicken confit recipe turns out. I'll show you guys some cool photos and give you the whole recipe on Instagram probably later tonight or tomorrow, assuming that it doesn't poison and kill my entire family. Then the cookbook is at boundlesscookbook.com. Available for pre-order. It's big. It's beautiful. Tons of cool photos. Tons of amazing, unique recipes, biohacked, you know, smoothies and cocktails and everything from wild game meat to plant pestos to just everything I tend to make on a regular basis is jam-packed into that cookbook, along with plenty of science and fun anecdotes. So you want to check that out. And I think that's about all the time that we have. So once again, Jay, it has been an absolute pleasure geeking out with you for the past hour and a half, along with all of you on Clubhouse.
Indeed, man. Enjoy it. Can't wait for the next one.
Awesome. All right, folks. Well, I'm Ben, along with Jay, signing out. Show notes are at bengreenfieldfitness.com/426. Have an amazing, amazing week. Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at bengreenfieldfitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.